J.P. Morgan Chase reports billions in profits. Stocks are riding high.
What about the rest of us?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, October 13th. Deepwater drilling in the Gulf? Sure. Roaming charges getting you deep in the pocket? The FCC is looking at that. And your dishwashing powder may not pack the punch you thought. But first,
we learned this morning J.P. Morgan Chase did quite well in the last quarter, profits up 23%. We also heard better-than-expected profit news last night from Intel and railroad company CSX. Let's say hello to our Wednesday economist, Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
So one reason stocks are up is that corporations are making money. But another is the Federal Reserve says it's looking at a crummy economy that it's ready to help. So, Richard, where do these two worlds come together?
Well, you know, first of all, it's important to recognize that stocks, or I should say rather corporate earnings, are a leading indicator. They tend to do better before the rest of the economy, and they tend to deteriorate before the rest of the economy. So seeing earnings improve is encouraging, and it's a necessary condition for the expansion to remain on track and improve. But it's not sufficient. Companies have been stashing a lot of these profits aside. They've been holding record levels of cash. What we really want to see is that translated into investment and hiring. And that has still not happened in a very big way.
Yeah, so now bringing these worlds together, I mentioned the Federal Reserve's outlook, but that statement from the Fed about how it's ready to print money again, that is from a meeting back in September. Do the latest happy corporate earnings reports change the Fed's calculation?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is, as I mentioned previously, rising profits are a necessary precondition for a sustained expansion, but it's not sufficient. We need to see these funds put to use. That has not been compellingly evident. And just to get a quarter of better earnings or even strong earnings from a couple of important companies isn't sufficient. They need to see those broader measures of economic improvement, more hiring in particular, and that's not at this point surely in hand.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks for laying this out for us, Richard DeKayser, Woodley Park Research. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
The Obama administration has lifted its ban on deepwater oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, today, the European Commission is proposing its own moratorium on deep-sea oil drilling, at least until the United States inquiry into the Gulf spill has been published. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with that story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So the European Commission seems to be more worried about deepwater drilling than our own government here in the States. I mean, would there likely be a moratorium there in Europe?
It seems doubtful, to be frank. It's a bit of a gesture. The European Commission doesn't have the power to impose a moratorium, and the member countries with major oil companies say they don't need one. They're confident their safety regulations are robust.
Now, we know BP and Royal Dutch Shell both have big operations in the Gulf of Mexico. What impact will lifting the moratorium have on businesses there?
Well, it's probably going to be many weeks before drilling resumes because all the companies there have to apply for new permits. Obviously, it's going to be less profitable in the future for these companies because of tougher regulations. But Nick McGregor of brokers Redmayne Bentley says BP and Shell wouldn't consider pulling out of the Gulf.
The amount of oil involved and the fact that they are restricted in the numbers of areas in the world in which they are welcome these days mean that they will still operate in this area and they will still pump resources into it.
Indeed, Shell seems to be trying to ingratiate itself with the American authorities, angling for new permits. Yesterday, the Shell CEO criticized BP's well design and lack of safety measures in the Gulf, putting as much distance between himself and BP as possible.
All right, Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you so much.
Okay, Steve.
Now, moving from underground oil to your gas tank, the EPA today is expected to increase the amount of ethanol allowed in gasoline. It's a contentious decision. Some groups oppose higher production of ethanol. Reporter Janet Babin joins us from North Carolina Public Radio with the latest. Hi, Janet.
Good morning, Bill.
How much of an ethanol increase are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a 5% increase here, from 10 to 15%. The ethanol industry says this kind of a jump won't harm engine performance in newer cars. But oil refiners are concerned that this may leave them exposed to any liability for possible engine damage. I mean, ethanol is a solvent, and some say it could harm things like catalytic converters in vehicles.
And is this ethanol boost a victory for environmental groups?
Actually, it's just the opposite. Ethanol production often happens on industrial farms that use lots of petroleum-based pesticides and fertilizers. The increased production, environmental groups say, could also take away land from wildlife habitat and could damage water quality. And it can raise the price of corn, and that could make food more expensive.
And what does the ethanol industry say about all that?
Yeah, so the ethanol industry says production's actually good for the environment because it replaces imported fuel oil and it's a renewable energy source. And they argue that, hey, the industry right now is creating jobs.
So, Janet, how do I know whether I'm buying gasoline with ethanol in it now?
Well, you might not even realize it, Bill, because it varies by state. Some states don't require that fuel be labeled if it does contain ethanol. And the EPA could also announce today a more uniform labeling program so we would know if there was ethanol in our fuel.
Janet Babin reporting live. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, October 13th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us in the United States. Many European governments, including the UK, have been looking to reduce public spending. That would include a lot of government jobs. But a report today warns about a rippling effect in the private sector that could cost as many as 500,000 more jobs. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
The British Prime Minister plans to tighten the government's purse strings and reduce the size of the public sector workforce. And he was relying on the country's privately run businesses to pick up the slack. So this morning's news may have spoiled his breakfast, because the report from accountant PricewaterhouseCoopers says his plans will hit private companies almost as hard. John Hawksworth is the chief economist at PwC. He expects most private sector job losses to be in the construction and service industries, as building projects are cancelled and contracts aren't renewed.
Public sector is a huge customer for many businesses, and it will be a long adjustment process to kind of wean themselves off the dependence on the public sector.
Areas like Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales will be particularly badly hit because their local economies rely heavily on government jobs and contracts. But Hawksworth says despite the job losses, the private sector will adapt and find new opportunities to make money. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
It looks about as global a city as you can get without leaving the U.S., with resorts such as Paris, the Venetian and Luxor. It's like taking a trip to another country, only you're not. You'd be in Vegas. And it was hit hard by the economic meltdown, no doubt. The New York Times says, though, it's still suffering badly. But Las Vegas Review-Journal entertainment columnist Doug Elfman says that's just not so. And we met at a popular gathering place on the Strip to talk about it. Doug Elfman, thanks for meeting me here at the Las Vegas Sun.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure.
So why this place? Why are we here talking near the Las Vegas Sun? It's a pretty touristy place, right?
This is quite the touristy place, you know, and as you can see, it's just wall-to-wall tourists, sort of, I mean, as much as you can get. Cars coming in, you can see the planes coming in, and unlike what some people might think, Vegas is sort of bouncing back.
So what are the signs of economic recovery, then?
Gambling revenue up 21%, casino proceeds up 4.5%, casino revenues up 12%. Visitors coming to Vegas has been up for 12 straight months to 25 million people. It's been up 2.5% this year. Car traffic's up 4.4%. I could go on and on. We have lots of signs, and if you live here and you actually come here, you know all this.
What are the sources for all this? Where'd you get this information?
All this stuff is all legitimate. I didn't make this up out of the desert sky. We're not fully recovered, obviously, but we're on the road.
When you talk to locals here, what are they telling you? You sort of work the beat, right?
Yeah. Okay, well, on the downside, there's quite a few people in town who've been working 60 hours a week for six days a week for 2 years, ever since the recession kicked in. Because remember, unemployment is high at 14%. So a lot of people are tired, but we still smile and we still get through it because it's Vegas and we're a service industry.
As a journalist myself, I throw out these facts to you about the high unemployment, high foreclosure rates here in Nevada. How do you dispute that? I mean, what do you say to me if I'm saying, you know what, look, I mean, yeah, it's Vegas. Of course it's busy. Of course there are people here. It's a vacation spot and all of that. But you can't trump the fact that you've got these high unemployment and high foreclosure numbers.
We are recovering now. I'm not saying that we don't have 14% unemployment. Think about it this way. Everybody loves analogies, right? So here's a good chicken and egg analogy for you. The chicken for Las Vegas is we have to get people in the rooms to spend money on gambling and spend money on shows and spend money on concerts and nightclubs and restaurants. And then when they do enough of that, then employers stop being afraid and they start hiring more people.
The eternal optimist. Doug Elfman, thanks.
Sure, thanks.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, October 13th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We told you earlier the government lifting of the deepwater drilling moratorium in the Gulf of Mexico. The oil industry may be able to hire back thousands of workers. But with tougher rules and regulations now in place, the industry might end up looking quite different, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
For one thing, smaller offshore drilling companies may not be able to survive. Fadel Gate is managing director of oil and gas research at Oppenheimer & Company. He says after the BP spill, the cost of an accident is too daunting for the little guys.
Which basically is going to limit the number of players to those who have the financial flexibility to absorb any future shock.
That, he says, means deepwater drilling in the Gulf will be limited to a handful of companies: Shell, Chevron, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and good old BP. Gates says some companies are already adjusting to the new landscape, putting their money into onshore drilling, which is seen as safer.
But nevertheless, most of the mega projects will be offshore in the deep water.
But don't expect the rigs to be up and running right away. Even though the Obama administration decided yesterday to lift the ban earlier than expected, analysts say it'll take weeks for companies to get in compliance with new regulations. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Right now, the National Football League is in the middle of what looks like a very profitable season, with television ratings doing very well. But behind closed doors, there's trouble brewing, a fight between the league's owners and players' union, one that today's Wall Street Journal reports could get ugly really, really fast. They're battling over how to split up the big money the NFL takes in. At stake is a lost season and a lot of lost revenue. Matthew Futterman wrote this morning's story for the Journal. He's with us live from New York. Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Doing well. Where are the negotiations right now?
They're pretty much stalled at the moment. There's not a lot of progress on either side. The owners haven't backed off their demands for essentially an 18% rollback in player pay, and the players haven't backed off their staunch opposition to any cut in salaries.
So no budging there. The NFL, though, Matthew, doesn't need a collective bargaining agreement right until March. So
well,
why
that is when it expires, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, why are they so concerned about it right now?
Well, one big reason they're concerned about it is because the sponsors who plan their marketing budget 6, 12, 18 months in advance are getting nervous about whether there's going to be a season next year or whether they want to be associated with a league that is having much labor strife. There's going to be a Pro Bowl, which is their all-star game, later on after the end of the postseason. And that's a typical kind of event that you'd want to get sponsors for. And, there's a question. Are players going to even show up to the Pro Bowl? Are there going to be protests there? If you're, a Fortune 500 company, is that something that you want to associate your brand with?
And is it possible, Matthew, that there could be no season next year?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's going to be no – I don't think they're going to miss an entire season, but there could be some missed games. I mean, the owners right now are very dug in terms of their desire to make some fundamental changes in the compensation system in football. And the players are risking their lives. They don't have guaranteed contracts, and they don't see why they should have to pay to increase the profits of the owners, and the teams are very profitable already.
And we're talking about a history lesson, too, because we've seen this happen before, right?
Well, I haven't seen it happen in a long time. The NFL has had labor peace ever since it's, the framework of the current collective bargaining agreement was worked out in the early 90s. But yes, back in the 80s, there were a couple of work stoppages with the NFL.
Matthew Futterman from the Wall Street Journal, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Ever been caught off guard by your cell phone bill? That's a subject of conversation today when the chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, outlines plans to prevent cell phone surprises. From Chicago Public Radio, Tony Arnold reports.
Roaming charges, text message fees, and using too many minutes. If you've ever experienced any of these symptoms, you may be one of 30 million Americans who suffer from
bill shock.
FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski says cell phone bills are out of control.
We see that the magnitude of the problem is large enough that it requires action. It won't fix itself.
Ellen Bloom says she is one of those 30 million Americans.
I have experienced bill shock.
Bloom is a senior director with Consumers Union. She says she wants to see a universal policy for cell phone companies, one that requires them to notify talkers and texters when they're getting close to their limits.
There's a lot of lack of awareness, and I don't think that the burden should fall solely on the consumer.
But she says cell phone users need to be more aware of extra charges in their contract. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
And speaking of paying bills, if you are good about paying yours, well, congratulations are in order, but you may also be charged an extra fee. Let's welcome Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Please explain.
It's called pay to pay. It's
pay
remarkable.
To pay.
The notion that you're being charged a fee to give them money is simply astounding. Let's look at some examples of this. Let's say you're running a little late with your mortgage payment or whatever. If you are to go to Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and you want to use their automated phone system, no human beings within sight, $15.
And this is not a late fee. This is just a charge for using their automated system.
Just a charge to pay your bill using automation. And when you talk to consumer advocates about what is the real cost of an automated transaction, a few cents, if that.
Yeah, isn't that the point? Part of the point of automation?
To save money, exactly. And yet these guys are charging $15. I asked Chase, how can you charge that much for an automated transaction? They said, well, that's how much we charge. And you look at some of the other charges out there. For instance, this week, Verizon Communications is introducing a new $3.50 charge if you pay your bill online, automated phone system, or to a service rep without using their recurring automatic bill paying system.
So that's unless you have it taken straight from your bank account?
Exactly.
Which some people don't like to do. I mean, it feels a little insecure, right?
Some people want to be in the driver's seat. It's that simple. And it's your money. You should be able to make that choice. Moreover, let's remember, you're giving money to a company. That's what you're doing. They're in the business of receiving your money for a service provided. So the notion that a Verizon, for example, will tack another $3.50 just because you're not paying them in the manner they would like to be paid, it's extraordinary.
So the only conclusion is pay attention and shop for that.
Pay attention, be sharp, and also complain, because pay to pay is just ridiculous.
We need more complaining, says Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Thanks.
Thanks, and pay up.
And finally, one Pennsylvania woman found out the hard way phosphates are bad for the environment.
Well, her dishwasher wasn't cleaning the dishes. She replaced the appliance, and the dishes still wouldn't get clean. Well, finally, she wrote a letter to Procter & Gamble, maker of Cascade.
They responded by telling her to stop using the detergent because it no longer contained phosphates. Phosphorus is banned in 15 states. When it enters waterways, it promotes algae growth, and when the algae dies, it sort of sucks the oxygen out of the water. It kills the fish.
Yeah, that's what it is. Dirty dishes or dead fishes? You decide.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a decision. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.